Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us today. This is Audrey Michelle, and I am here again with Sam Bakanin. Sam is the author of Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited. He and I have been doing a series of shows, and he should be in here in a minute.
Hello.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
Yes. Hello, Audrey. How are you?
How was your weekend?
Okay. As long as we survived, it's okay.
There you go. It's all about survival.
It's all about survival.
I was just telling the audience about your book and how we're doing a series of different shows relating to abuse and Sam being a narcissist, and I am codependent, so he and I have some very interesting conversations since we are, according to him, soulmates on the subject as well as enemies in a way on this as well. Today we're going to talk about leaving a relationship with a narcissist. Sam and I have decided to bring some poetry into our shows relating to the subject about one of my pieces, which is called Lesser Girl. Probably the piece that best fits the way that I felt. When you first leave this situation, you're so insane that you don't know where you are, but some black hole is in front of you and fate's telling you follow this blackness, there's some light at the end. And I think I wrote this at the point where I saw the light before I had come to it, at least at the point that I finally did see that it really did exist. And it was about 3.5 years of torture of attempting to heal later. So this is called Lesser Girl.
Joy falls like one's pure snow upon a ground of mud too dark to stain. A melody of salty tears, frozen drips and dirty memories are all that surround. Morals once existed in the tomb she calls her skin. The walls can't speak, but they all know. Their windows sneer at her image in disgust, while the mirror reflects all that it has heard. A lesser girl, she knows she is, as that is how she's labeled. No one sees what falls beneath. A heart that cannot breathe but pain. Sing with me, lesser girl, and you shall be renamed. From grace you fell under their spell. Good intentions were laid upon the floor. This morning's dew awakened eyes, and eyes once blind now realize. Night gifted an epiphany to an undeserving dreamer. To save one's soul, you must retreat. Become oneself with your past being. A reunion of the still pure heart and the thickly covered, filthy skin. But dance with me, lesser girl. Through music, find salvation. Hope can change ring's frequency to a dryer station. The mirror breaks upon the floor and rids our years of luck being poor. Bad luck myths only exist if air is soaked with hopelessness.
We tried to do this interview 2 weeks ago when we had some technical problems. We are attempting, hopefully successfully, to do the interview today. And first thing I'm going to bring up was possible reactions to abuse. What were the different reactions after leaving an abusive relationship?
Well, there are essentially three types. Becoming an abuser, denying reality and usually becoming a stalker, or withdrawing altogether, generally speaking. Of course, other strategies, but these are the three main ones.
Yes, and I have met people who embody all three. It's amazing that, I think I've said this before, but every situation that I have faced, which pretty much is every single thing that you depict, I could say that I definitely experienced something like it. Whenever I read your one or two examples of specific situations, they're my example. And it's amazing to me in psychiatry in general, when you have some kind of diagnosis, how you can pretty much checkmark anything. But when it comes to your work, it's not just a checkmark of a side effect, actual step-by-step experience that he has. And it's my experience out in the world. Does anybody know that? But it's the fact that it's common enough, you know, even to some lower degree, even that you could identify it as a possible, is just so out of this world to me. I think that the biggest thing that I found in your work and in your interest in your work was that there was life.
Thank you for the compliment. But I think you have been doing with your poetry very much what I've been doing with my elaborate and baroque prose. I think of the experience of abuse, in my view, to some extent, better than I did.
Wow.
And
thank you.
No, because Poetry is a much more potent weapon than prose and far more accurate. It resonates far better with inner experiences, while prose, it is better to describe outer realities, objective realities, and so on. Poetry is the language of the soul.
A lot of people don't understand it.
Yeah, poetry is less accessible because most poets use kind of a private language, the connection between the words, which this inner linkage is supposed to provoke or evoke, or doesn't work because far less accessible than prose. But once someone does get through the barrier far better than anything prose can do. I mean, that's why I think there's what's going on in this diet.
It's just saying how every single thing you say, everything you do, you're inept, you're worthless every day. Every thought you have is crazy or stupid or nuts. And after all of the time, I saw this movie. I don't know if you saw Changing Lanes. Did you see that? Talked about a time period where they would take a woman that would go anywhere against the police and they would put them in a psychiatric ward so that they didn't have to deal with them. And you can tell people you're sane and they're not going to believe you. And after years and years of being in these insane asylums, these women were insane. And that's what happened with me. By the time I left, I was insane. I didn't have any of my own views. They were so diluted by all of this negative abuse that I literally was insane. And so after about years when I started to gain some sanity back. I mean, it took that long. And that's when that poem came out. It basically caused a person to become insane, to be abused after all those years. I would
yeah, sure. Of course.
And that's
course
why you were
conditioned.
You were saying anxiety when you go to court and stuff that the abusers looked at as put together perfect. You know, he can manipulate the system with the number one specific thing.
You said, look at this woman. She's crazy. So that was your reaction.
Society is abusing. The majority of victims, something like 70-80%, and by definition, they are abusive to women. Now, that bias is not operated by any measure. So society is very inherently and structurally anti-female bias, and the instruments of society, the institutions of society, tend to re-pathologize the victim, to re-abuse the victim. That's why society and societal tools, such as judges or police, law enforcement agencies, tend to identify much more with the user than with the victim. They are indeed far closer to the abuser in their conduct and in their state of mind than they are to the victim. Women, in this sense, although they are the absolute majority of the population, they are a minority in the way they are being treated. And so that's it. It's very sad. But abusers get along in society and are highly appreciated, sometimes become pillars of the community, and always in courts and elsewhere, because they resonate. They represent some of the facets of the system. It's politically incorrect to mention them, but they're there.
So how is their ability to know, like we talked about in previous conversations on the show as well as off the show, the kind of things that I'm facing when it comes to the court systems. And this is years later where I am more sane than he does. And it's unbelievable the way that the court systems work against you. How do you overcome when you first leave the situation? I don't know if there is an answer. I had to go against everyone, my family, my friends. I had nobody. I had no money. I got an allowance. You know, everything was the same. You know, he turned my son against me. I was completely on my own. At that point, you know, especially, I had no idea what to do. Now I'm clueless. What kind of suggestions do you have for someone that is leaving and dealing with the court system that will help them to have some kind of leeway?
The system. Don't ignore the system. Play along. It's collaborative and cooperative. Don't observe and follow and obey all decisions and instructions issued by judges, police officers, court-appointed evaluators, guardians ad litem, and social workers, and the zillion other functionaries of the state and that are there, essentially, but you should pretend that they are there to help you. You should play along.
Play dumb in some ways.
Play dumb and play along. Never circumvent the system, object, never protest. These are very bad strategies. The system is stronger than you, bigger than you, and it's going to suppress and crush you. And you have a lot to lose, for instance, access to your children. The system knows that. And the system implicitly threatens you with these penalties. So this is number one. Number two, expose your ex for what he is. If he is not all exes are abusers or narcissists, of course, but your ex user, narcissist, paranoid, psychopath, expose him from within the system. Now, there are ways of doing this. All these types of abusers, especially narcissists, have soft spots, vulnerabilities. They are sensitive to criticism, to disagreement. They have inflated ego. It's easy to prick it. They are grandiose. They live in fantasy. So if you act on these chinks in the armor, these points of vulnerability, the facade of the narcissist is likely to crumble. And he's likely to crumble in open court or with the social worker and so on. You should think of yourself, you should demolish the facade. How do you demolish things? You place explosives in strategic points. You don't just throw bombs at the building. You don't just blanket explode the building. You place very small charges in very, very strategic locations. And then you explode them simultaneously and the facade crumbles. That you should do with the narcissist. I have an article on my website titled The Narcissist in Court. And I have a video on my YouTube channel titled "From Narcissist in Court and in Custody" or something like that. So,
will you offer your URLs to find the article on the YouTube real fast?
It's youtube.com/Sam Batney, one word.
Okay.
My name, Sam Batney. And there's about 140, close to 140 videos.
Wow, you do about 10 a week, huh?
It's a pretty big collection by now. And yeah, one of these videos deals with how to demolish the facade of the narcissist in court. And so these are the two pieces of advice I have to give you. Pretend that you're a friend of the system and that the system is your friend, although you know better, you know that it's not. And secondly, demolish the narcissist facade and do it cleverly. And how to do it is there. You got the tips in the article and in the video.
And then, I know we talked about this last time, but since we weren't able to get audio working, this was an important thing for me to discuss because it gave me so much relief, was when I discussed with you the situation with my son, and I had never put his father down to him. And he had made a few comments at one point. He said, you know, my dad's an android. And I said, what's an android? Well, they look like a person. They talk like a person, but they don't have a heart. And then the next time he said something to me, he was 4, and he said to me, my dad has a bad brain. It makes him do bad things. And I said to him, what do you mean your dad has a bad brain? Well, it makes him do bad things, Mom. And I said, well, I don't think he does bad things on purpose. And he says, Mom, I know my dad. I know his smiles, and he does bad things on purpose. The reaction I had wasn't what I intended. I was like out of breath. I was driving, and I said, how do you know that? And it was so, I did not mean to say that. But after that, I remembered how people didn't believe me and didn't understand me and didn't discuss it with me. And I did not want to be the type that would sit here and let my son get abused and say, no, your dad's great. So it wasn't an intentional reaction. But at the same time, from then on, I was open with him about the things that was going on. And when his dad would make promises, I would say, remember, you know, be excited, have fun, but just remember that generally it's not going to happen. And 90% of the time doesn't. But I felt so guilty because they say, don't talk bad about the other parent, where I wasn't sure what talking bad was. But you believe that it's important to be straightforward and honest with the children. And that was such a great thing for me. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. I believe in three things, essentially. One, that it is not such a bad thing to be exposed to a narcissist early on in life, because the world is becoming more and more narcissistic. Narcissistic values are being upheld and encouraged and egged on. Narcissists are more and more numerous. And they are in the workplace. Your son may get married to a narcissist unwittingly. You may have narcissistic sons and daughters. It also happens. There's a genetic component. In other words, narcissists are predators and we live in a jungle. So it's not so bad to learn the ways of the tiger before you come across an actual tiger. So that's the first point. Yes, it's unfortunate that the child has a narcissistic father. But on the other hand, there's a silver lining. Your son will learn how to cope with narcissists. And in a world in which narcissists proliferate, that's a major competitive advantage, survival edge. This is point number one. Point number two, it is absolutely a wrong piece of advice given by social workers and lawyers and you name it. Everyone gives you this piece of advice. Never badmouth the other parent. Never put him down. Never expose him for what he is.
What do they call it? They call it parental alienation syndrome.
Don't create parental alienation syndrome. In other words, let's get rid of the politically correct speech and call a spade. They are asking you to lie to your child. And I don't believe in lying. I don't believe that a lie, which is a negative thing, can underlie anything positive. I don't believe in lying to your child. I believe in telling your child the truth. Truth doesn't have to be rough in the form of tough love, nor frightening, but the truth. You should sit with your child. Age of 4 sounds good to me. Sit with the child and say, explain to the child that his father is special in some ways. Everyone is special, and his father is special in some way, and that he has positive traits and so on, but he also has negative ones. And educate the child to be wary of these negative traits and behaviors of the other parent. You see, narcissists, the main thing with narcissism is that narcissists don't recognize boundaries. They regard other people, especially their children, as objects, instruments of gratification. There is no knowing how far the narcissist will and can go. Some narcissists are willing to go as far as incest. Others go as far as physical abuse. They all engage in psychological and verbal abuse of the child. You have to equip your child with weapons, with an arsenal of countermeasures. Otherwise, you are not a responsible parent. You are sacrificing your child for the sake of pretend and political correctness. That is bad parenting. But yes, my second advice is to tell your child the truth. My third advice, trust your child's natural wisdom. You see, at the beginning, your child will probably resent your word. He will resent the fact that you are so-called bed-mouthing the other parent. You may even alienate the child. He may be estranged. He may side with the other parent, with the victim. He may regard you as the abuser for telling the truth, for informing him about the bad qualities and traits of the other parent. You may have to go to a rough patch where your son or your daughter actually resent you for demolishing their fantasy regarding their father. But this is a temporary patch. Trust your child's inner wisdom. The child will ultimately come around to your point of view. The child will reach the very same conclusions and judgments regarding the other parent. And when this happens, there will be reconciliation, and the child will understand.
Okay. What I say to him a lot is that Dad loves you very, very much. He loves you as much as he knows how to love, but the way that he loves is not the same as the way that you and I know what love is. It's true. In my ex's mind, he loves his son. Now, he's a part of him. He's an extension of him. Right now, he's a perfect extension. He does well for him. Now, let's say one day he does something that he doesn't agree with. He might just stop the love for that momentary time. But in his mind, he loves his son. And so that's what I say. And when his dad's being very good to him, which of course happens when he wants to get back at me, he might be very good to him. So he'll want to be with him more. I think it was about 2 weeks ago. I had full custody for about 2 months, and that's when I first contacted you, when he was trying very, very underhandedly to get that back. And he did get it back some unbelievable way. My son, he's a laundromat. Everyone says, wow, your son's much happier. He's doing so much better. And I would say to them, you know, really, because they could just notice in a few minutes. And then he came back in, and of course, right away, he bought him a puppy dog, which means he wants to be at his dad's house more. And, you know, took him everywhere, bought him everything. You know, man was 13 months behind in child support. All of a sudden, he can buy $500 toys and whatever the case may be. At the time, I just said, you know, be careful. Just remember, is daddy ever going to change? And he says, no. He knows his dad's always going to go back. But then it was about 2 months after that, very depressed again, as he'd been diagnosed earlier. He was very self-destructive. And I sat down and I explained to him, he said, you know, if you're happy here one day and the next day you're very sad, you can see, you know, you're happy, you're sad. But if I, with my hands, I was showing if you go over this period of time and every day you're a little bit sadder, then you can't really tell. And he started to cry a little bit. And I said, when you hit yourself, it's saying, I'm bad, but you're not bad. You're perfect. If anybody ever says you're bad, they're wrong. And he just burst into tears. And he says, I'm not bad, mommy. So for 2 months, I kind of had that reaction where he was angry at me for putting things into perspective. He forgets. I get lost in his brainwashing for a now 7-year-old kid as well. They're actually more resilient than an adult.
Yeah, they are. You just reminded me that there might be a fourth piece of advice. Never compete with the narcissist. The narcissist can outbuy you, outsmart you. If he buys him gifts, never buy the kid more gifts. Don't play by the narcissist's rules. That's precisely what he wants you to do. He wants to draw you into his turf. You don't have an environment with rules, to establish an environment which is rule-free. If you buy things, the narcissist will buy more. So don't play his game. Don't alter your behavior. Don't change yourself as the outcome of how the narcissist behaves.
You're telling me that a child of a narcissist and a codependent, they become codependent, they're narcissistic. I think you said 4-to-1. We've discussed this, Gavin and I, and he is very much like I am, trying to please everybody, trying to over and over go after people that don't like him, to give him gifts, do things like I did as a child and like I still do. You know, I told you once my definition of codependency is trying to prove your worth to those that don't recognize it. And that I am completely it. My life's a wreck because of it. Bring in the wrong people into life because I want to prove, look, I'm a good person. You're never going to get that reaction. The same thing that works with abuse. Coming a lot like me, and he's just so scared to be like his dad. But, you know, I train him now. Bullies with these people when they're to you at school. If you act like you don't care, no matter what you do, they'll stop. They only want a reaction. So as much as I can give him advice, I follow it.
I think now that you mentioned codependence, I think codependents have sort of a short circuit. Where other people distinguish between perceptions and facts, codependents believe that the two are interrelated. They believe that by establishing an overwhelming body of facts, they can change perceptions. In other words, they believe that if they behave differently, if they prove things, if they demonstrate kind of conduct, or if they do things, if they buy objects, in other words, that if they change the objective external environment, they can also change the perceptions of people. And that is, of course, completely untrue, because the perceptions are 10% based on facts and 90% based on emotions, personal history, and a million other factors over which the codependent has no control whatsoever and can never change. So you cannot change other people's perceptions by changing yourself.
Of course not.
Altering your behavior, buying them, you cannot buy love, you cannot buy appreciation, you cannot, and this is a big mistake. Normal people, you know, who are not codependent, they, you know, they behave the way they behave, period. And if this alters someone's perception, all for the better. And if it doesn't alter his perception, look at him, or the hell with her. Codependents are not like that. They are obsessed with changing people's perceptions, and they become compulsive about it. And this is what we call abandonment anxiety. They believe that if they do not, if they fail in changing other people's perceptions, these people will abandon them. But they don't understand that if these people were to abandon them, no trigger is needed. They will abandon them.
Mm-hmm.
The first abandonment, of course, is parental abandonment. And our parents abandon us not because we do or we are too little, too young to do or not do anything. They abandon us because of their own internal programming. There's very little we can change them. We don't accept it. We codependents don't accept it. They try, you know, and so they are being, other people describe them as clinging. Because of this, you know, desperate attempts to change everyone around them, to be acceptable, to be rendered respectable. It's a hopeless pursuit.
It's a hopeless pursuit. Phase in your whole life, basically you've told you're worthless and you're nothing, and beliefs that are making you believe that other people are thinking that. I mean, how can they see you as worthwhile if you're not? You know, how can they think that you offer them anything if you offer anything? And your self-esteem, like the third party that you stated when you left with me, I mean, absolutely, people look at all my point of view and they think this person has, what does she have to be insecure about? And I am fighting to believe that I'm even worth breath after everything that I've experienced. And the whole thing is, how can I break that? Because, I mean, I don't know, it kind of makes me think about things, because my friends, every single job, every place I've been, I fought with people because of my codependency. I've fought more. I feel like people that has come into my life has had those narcissistic qualities. Do you think some of that I just imagine? Because it just seems they all steal, they all lie, they all, you know, try to bring you down lower in my own mind.
Well, absolutely, lying and being the bad character altogether is a narcissism. To be a narcissist, you need to lack the ability to have an absolute as objects, fully object, to the point that you treat them as you would your television or refrigerator. They have functions, and if they don't function, you discard them, and you buy new ones, and you get new ones, and so on. So narcissists are a category all their own.
No, I just see that, and the thing with the narcissist, hard as that is, I do believe that there is a large majority of the population narcissistic, and do you know which of those individuals I'm describing that were narcissistic? And I would say probably 1 in 5, but I also bring in a lot of addicts, so that's a different thing. They might have a heart, they have empathy, but they're an addict, so if you owe your money, it's not because they discharge you. They may feel guilty and hate themselves, but they're an addict. So the different types, it's not all narcissistic personality that you bring into your life, but they're all abusive.
abusive. He said one time it's like a soulmate. I remember one doctor told me you can look to the room and it doesn't matter what their name or face, you just like know each other. So that's why I say they're all names, they're different faces, they're this and that, you know, they're all abusive. And she says it doesn't matter. You look across the room and it's you found your soulmate, which is so funny because you guys are the same kind of thing. So they're not all narcissistic, but they're all abusive, whether it be by their inability to care or their inability to function as a human being, but they're all very abusive for whatever their own reason may be.
I think abuse is also the result of socioeconomic and cultural realities. We used to live in very small, tiny communities where abuse was a stupid strategy, was anti-survival. You had a limited pool of people to prove, and once you went through all of them, you excommunicated. Excommunication at that period meant essentially death. So people did not abuse, not because they were abused. It was not a very wise strategy. Today we live in a city like New York or Tokyo or Sao Paulo, and you're surrounded by 20 million. There are 20 million potential victims who can abuse to your heart's content from the moment you're born to the moment you die, and you would deal as potential victims. And all the social control and punishment mechanisms have crumbled because of the sheer number of people and because opportunities today to abuse and to get away with it are enormous. And this was not the case when you lived in a village with 200 people. So the structure of society also encourages abuse. That means also that I personally believe, the Bible says, that people are essentially evil.
Me too.
I believe that the main function of society is to restrain this evil. This is why we have law and police and courts and a million, zillion, billion other...
Law and order, but the sad thing is that gives those people the power that makes them into abusers themselves.
Exactly. So it's no getting around the fact that people, some of them abuse because they love it, adore it, it's fun, it's great, it gives them... These people are called this. Some people abuse because they regard other people as functions, instruments, objects. These people are called narcissists. Some people abuse because it gives them benefits, tangible benefits, and repeated benefits. And these people are called psychopaths. All diagnostic and statistical manual is actually a gallery of abusers, a catalog of motivations to abuse. Even the more innocuous mental health disorders and personality disorders are essentially about abuse. So yes, you're right. You're surrounded with abuse. The extent of abuse, the amount of abuse is growing exponentially. The number of people, because of the reasons I've mentioned, it's much easier to abuse. The social sanction for abuse basically crumbled. Today you are punished only if you commit a crime. In 200 years ago, you would have been punished for a variety of misdeeds, the vast majority of which were not crimes at all. You could have been punished 200 years ago if you insulted someone, or if you did not reciprocate, if you were not helpful. You would have been punished for that.
And
the issue is, in let's say, up to the Industrial Revolution, people lived in very, very tight-knit, small communities, and they were penalized not only for criminal conduct, but they were penalized for antisocial conduct. Today we live in gigantic non-communities, and we are penalized if we are caught. Only 3% are caught, by the way. So we are penalized only for our criminal conduct, but we are no longer penalized for antisocial conduct. Antisocial is chic. It's in fashion. You know, people admire psychopaths. Serial killers are celebrities. It comes to this.
Yes, very true. We had a talk about the DSM and how it's changing in 5 years. Seems like rather than seeing things as they are combined, them to make them seem more serious. A lot of people believe they're taking them out because of them to be real conditions. It's a little bit of a different take on it. What did you have to say about that?
First of all, they're not taking out anything at all. No, what they're doing is they created a hyper-diagnostic category called personality disorder, a single diagnostic category called personality disorder. And then each patient is going to be diagnosed with a personality disorder with a specific dimension. So what used to be called narcissistic personality disorder will from now on be called personality disorder with narcissistic dimension. I fail to see the difference. I think it's just essentially a renaming.
Yes.
The philosophy behind this decision, I suggested to do the same thing 15 years ago. In 1997, I've written a series of articles proposing to unite all the personality disorders into a single diagnostic category. And in 1999, when the first edition of my book came out, it was there. You can take the first edition and see it.
Mm-hmm.
Exact same thing. What they're saying is this. The differences between psychopath and narcissist, for instance, these differences are so subtle, so nuanced, that very often people are diagnosed with both mental health conditions. The difference is really arcane. It's very difficult to tell the difference between psychonarcissists. The difference between, let's say, histrionic and somatic narcissists is vanishingly small. These are the same disorder. So a mistake was made in the diagnostic and statistical manual in the current edition of differentiating too much, creating a proliferation of unnecessary diagnostic categories. And the result was comorbidity. Patients were diagnosed with more than one disorder. You had patients with seven concurrent disorders. disorders. And it's absolutely monitored. A personality disorder is like, you know, depression. 27 variants.
Is that where they have like seasonal disorders?
And
like
seasonal. And yeah. There are 27 types of depression. But you first diagnose the patient with depression, and then you assign to the patient
a label.
And a label. And same will happen personality disorder. And by the way, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is valid only in the United States and to some extent in Japan.
If you're looking for information on a disorder, it's not to go. It's basically just talk to a psychiatrist basically how to diagnose. So that means that if you look at it as what is real and what isn't real, then it probably is going to be completely off. Basically, that's just for a psychiatrist to diagnose and label.
Yeah, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual was invented at the request of the insurance industry. They wanted to reimburse psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists based on mutually acceptable diagnostic categories.
I used to think it more as like a Merck manual. You read about a drug and get information. It really isn't the place to get any kind of factual information to understand.
Yeah. Additionally, the DSM is not valid in the vast majority of the world. The vast majority of the world is using the ICD, the World Health Organization manual, International Classification of Diseases. And there, the narcissistic personality disorder diagnostic category remains. And they are pioneers. They have a sort of a catch-all diagnostic category. I am very happy with what the DSM is doing. I think it's catching up to the ICD, catching up to recent thinking and recent research and studies. Current edition of the DSM, DSM-4, made a mess of things, created complete chaos. I'm asking you, what's the difference between psychopath and narcissist? Narcissism and psychopathy, I've always held this view, and I wrote about it as early as 1997. Narcissism and psychopathy are 2 points on a continuum. They are two manifestations of essentially the same disorder. And to distinguish between them was wrong to begin with. And so now they are being united, and I'm happy with it.
You know, when you sent me the poem, it was a short poem, but basically your point of view when we were talking about how I'm going to read something and you give me your point of view as an abuser. Yes, it was your point of view, and I didn't realize until a couple of days later what I was trying to think about was that you was more like, I do care about you, I do love you, but I just can't put you first, I'm first. And I can see that as an abuser. What I realized a couple of days later is that because that wasn't my specific situation, mine was as sadistic, he enjoyed watching me suffer and being pain. So that showed me a whole, even though you've described to me the difference between a somatic and cerebral and how sadistic is the one that just is purely to be evil. Until I read the poem of yours, I didn't gather the fact that that's true. You don't have a person in pain. You just don't care enough to not keep her there. I mean, mine just loves it, just laughs. Just, I mean, there's nothing more exciting than to watch me disintegrate.
You may have been a sadistic narcissist. Sure. I'm also a sadistic narcissist.
Really?
But my sadism is directed outwards. I torture and torment groups of people or collectives or through my writings, through my interviews. I'm a political and economic commentator.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I don't see your things as just blatant rants. Like a lot of times in blogs, you'll see people ranting things. I mean, you have a point in everything that you use.
Yeah, but I don't write or preach or give interviews or to better the world. I do it in order to create pain. I do it.
What? It's so beautiful because you do better the world. I don't know about those articles. I mean, that's just something that in the long term...
That's an incidental and utterly unintended and inadvertent outcome.
But doesn't it give you some pleasure to do that?
To better the world?
To better people's lives, like I told you how many times in my own personal...
Completely
your reactions
irrelevant.
When I tell you how much you've bettered my life, maybe it's more you're proud than you're happy for me. Maybe it's more the fact that your insight was enabled that rather than... I'm glad you're doing well.
I think I didn't delve into it, so I analyze it. I can't be sure of what I'm about to say, but I think it translates internally into a feeling of power. It's omnipotence. If I can change someone's life, never mind, for better or for worse, it proves that I have power, that I'm omnipotent.
Would you prefer to change it for the better than the worse?
Absolutely neutral.
Because I know they prefer it to be in ways that people feel lesser. They prefer fear.
I derive pleasure when I hurt people. I am content with my power when I make their lives better. But I don't derive pleasure.
Or you'd actually be, not specific to me, but just in the situation, you'd actually feel better about it if it was in a negative way.
Not sure. I derive pleasure. That's surely fair. You can tell the difference between enjoying something and simply...
Oh, I can see. You're when it comes to that. I know when I hit on a subject or something that you are very, very interested in as to something you're not, because you really just won't even reply to it. But if it's something you're interested in, you'll have like all these different...
No, I don't know why you are trying to rephrase what I'm saying. I'm very clear. I derive pleasure. I enjoy hurting people.
That's it.
I feel powerful when I'm the lives.
Because you make my better.
I feel powerful, but I don't enjoy it. I feel powerful and I enjoy it if I hurt them.
That's
so
good.
When I hurt people, there is this added dimension of torment. So this is sadism.
It really is. It's hard to imagine it.
In my case, my sadism is not directed fully at my wife. It is directed outwards to my readers, collectives, people I reach, interviews and so on. This is because there are two types of narcissists. I think we've dwelt upon it.
Now, you said there were three types, and you always have a major one, and then you always have tons of
little. In this sense, regarding this issue, there are two types. There is the narcissist whose home life is stable, and all the rest in his life is chaotic.
Okay.
And there is another narcissist whose career is stable and his home life is chaotic.
Yes.
So I belong to the first type. My home life is very stable and the rest of my life is very chaotic.
This
is where I expressed my sadism.
It was definitely the opposite. Okay, so I got you. But no, but what I was saying with the three different types, because you said you're a cerebral narcissist, but all narcissists, like my ex was a sadistic with side effects of cerebral and somatic, whereas you said that basically every type has a main type and then the time lives will exhibit characteristics of another. So you're not sadistic, but of course, since you're a narcissist and you possess all three at times, have that quality.
Yeah, I'm a cerebral narcissist. You can classify narcissists using a variety of axes and dimensions. So
I use yours.
One of the axes is cerebral, so I'm cerebral. Another axis is word. The loose place, in my case, is home. My home life is stable. The rest is chaotic.
What is it called again?
Each narcissist.
It broke up when you labeled it. What was it called?
You have compensatory and decompensatory narcissists. I'm stable with my home life and chaotic outside. And sadism is usually expressed where the chaos is. Sadism is used to create chaos.
Right.
So if you are married to a narcissist who is stable outside but chaotic in his home life, he will express his sadism in the home life.
Oh, yes, you are. Someone who is the sadistic type, is it something that just occurs where the work life that is the chaotic dimension, or is it something that's in their character? Is that be more like the cerebral than somatic? As you said, the somatic offers the sex, they don't have as much of the intellectual, so maybe they would be more chaotic in their business world. What actually, that wouldn't work either. So what is it? Is it something that's chosen, or is it something that is just a part of the character?
No, the locus of stability is usually the outcome of upbringing and yes, whether you're somatic or cerebral. Somatic narcissists are likely to be stable in their career or in some outside pursuit and unstable at home.
Mm-hmm.
And cerebral narcissists, the other way around.
Okay. Now, that makes me even more realize that mine was sadistic, which is completely, one of your characters. But he's very, very centered at work. He's very, very cerebral, but he is very sadistic more than anything else, at least to the view I had. Granted, it was the family versus the business, but he's sadistic in business more in underlying ways. But no, I mean, he really is sadistic more than either one of the other two. Is that possible?
Right. Yes, it could be that he is overwhelmingly sadistic. I'm sadistic as a biology, maybe.
Right,
sadistic,
right. So on that line where you combine narcissism and sociopath, that we used to be considered a sociopath as someone who is sadistic.
Yeah, that's a common mistake, owing to media representations. Media presented psychopaths as all of them being potential serial killers, sexual sadists, and what have you. The vast majority of psychopaths are not sadists at all, and they don't engage in physical violence and so on. They are co-artists, they are
manipulators
and so on, but they don't have a physical dimension, and they're not even sadists. And that's a media misrepresentation of psychopathy.
Codependency, I guess we should get back into that. When we talk about the codependency, and I was saying with my son, how can I ensure, because I see him getting so many of my qualities, in my, characteristics, I wouldn't say qualities, of where, the kids that are mean to him, he goes after being their friends. A child early on now to develop, even if you see that to some degree, can they have developed codependency already at 7 years old?
No, not really.
So what can you do? Because he's developing it. He's on that route.
Yeah, that's a tough one. You cannot really prevent the development of codependence unless and until you change yourself. At this early age, what we call the formative years, between 0 and 6, the main channel of personality development and formation is via imitation,
okay,
via emulation.
So I have time.
Yeah, you have time on the one hand, but on the other hand, if you still behave codependently, if you're still a raging codependent, he's going to pick that up, operate it in his personality. You've got to work on yourself, not on him.
Now, I've tried absolutely everything except for the 12-step program, and I know from reading that sex addicts, drug addicts, it's imperative that they put that into their treatment therapy. I looked up the meetings. I mean, that's the only thing left I think I can do to get better from my codependency, because I, as you've stated, I've tried so much, and I am so far from cured. Do you think the 12-step program holds a good place in any kind of these disorders?
12 steps deals mainly with other issues.
No, they have Codependence Anonymous.
Yeah, I know. They have everything anonymous. They have Overeaters Anonymous, Codependence Anonymous.
Yeah.
Even Narcissist Anonymous and so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah, and that one's going to work.
In truth, 12-step is a highly specific behavior modification program, and it's not suitable for everything. For instance, I do not think it's suitable for codependence. The 12-step programs deal mainly with one's narcissism, with one's lack of self-control. That's why you surrender to a higher power.
I gotcha.
You get rid of your narcissism. That's why you take it one day at a time in order to control your impulses and so forth. So these are not the problems of codependence.
I'm not narcissistic, but at the same time, every single decision I make is from a codependent point of view. Literally, my life is built around it. Every view I have, every word I hear and the way I interpret it. I mean, my life is surrendered to codependency, and I can't even take a small piece of it out. I can't get myself out of that whatsoever, no matter what I try. So what do you think?
The group of therapies that deal with inner voices, with conditioning, early childhood conditioning, and so on, are the most successful. So we're talking about cognitive behavior therapy, GEMA therapy.
What's GEMA?
Schema is a type of therapy. You can look it up online. It basically reformulates your inner schemes, your inner structure, psychological structure. And it's cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, and to some extent Gestalt, and all other treatment modalities that change your inner voices, reprogram your internal dialogues, reframe the way you perceive yourself and the world and your behavior and so on. These are going to be codependent, are these nagging inner voices that they cannot get rid of. In Gestalt, they call them tapes that you cannot get rid of. And there are quite a few very successful treatment modalities that get rid of these voices, reprogram your cognition, and make yourself and the world differently. Actually, dependence and hypnosis. It's pretty successful. Treating codependence is just as successful ever. Narcissists have the same voices. They have voices which are judgmental, sadistic, self-loathing, self-hating, punishing, guilt-inducing. These are voices, internal voices, or what we call introjects, that narcissists absorbed as children and adolescents. But with narcissists, these voices are far, far more difficult to get rid of, because the narcissist is positively invested in these voices. The narcissist loves his narcissism. Narcissists are emotionally invested in narcissistic personality disorder. They think their disorder makes them unique, them tools and weapons in a cruel, hostile world. So it's very difficult to induce a divorce between the narcissist and his mental health disorder. Codependents, on the other hand, usually feel bad. They are usually unhappy with themselves. They want to change. So it's
narcissistic personality, they even more so hate themselves, just in a more covered way. You said nobody hates themselves more than the narcissist.
Yes, narcissists have these internal voices that generate in them self-hatred, self-loathing, fluctuating sense of self-worth, lack of self-esteem, and so on and so forth. This is all very true. But the solution to this self-hatred and the solution to this self-loathing and lack of self-esteem is narcissism. A narcissist loves their narcissism. Take away the narcissism of the narcissist and you are left with someone who hates himself.
In their mind, disgusting, full of shame.
Yes, guilt-ridden, yes, shame-ridden, and so on. So this is why narcissists are married for life, Catholic marriage, to their disorder. It's impossible to separate the narcissist from his disorder, because the narcissist believes firmly that his disorder is good, adaptive, helps him overcome, helps survive, is a great invention. His false self is a great invention because it renders him omnipotent and omniscient, where actually he is ignorant, powerless. So it's like chitty chitty bang bang. You know, it's a great tool, great instrument. Codependents, on the other hand, while they have exactly the same voices like narcissists, self-loathing, self-hatred, shame, and so on and so forth, codependents are unhappy. It's called ego dystonic. Codependents are ego dystonic, and narcissist ego syntonic. They love themselves. They love their disorder. Codependents hate their disorder. They are unhappy with their disorder and want to get rid of it if possible. And this is therapy comes in, and that's why the prognosis is very good. I recommend therapy to each and every single codependent, and I do not recommend therapy to any narcissist. So waste time and money.
No, but I've gone through so much. I mean, granted, I'm still changing prescriptions for my depression and anxiety all the time. The doctors I work with went and admitted, narcissistic. She was very, very, pointed out my age, which I've learned from you is more post-traumatic. But at the same time, she was amazing. She was in California when I left there. Her, but we started to, who, like, you know, said they side toward the narcissist and they value higher. And I think that they always looked at me as naive or stupid, rather than actually suffering a major disorder, and they put me down through it. You know, they were very, very, they put you down, feel like you're less than you are, because they don't understand what you're trying to do.
Well, I don't think you can generalize, of course. Or a therapist, there are 3 million mental health practitioners in the United States.
Of course.
So they could generalize. But yes, you're right that mental health practitioners, therapists, especially in social workers more so, suffer from two shortcomings or handicaps. Narcissistically, as white knights out to save you from an impossible situation, and then disappoint them if you refuse to be saved in accordance with them. They're very angry. So there's this, or is kind of underestimating the severity of the problem and throwing medicines at it, throwing medication at it, saying, okay, this problem, you know, can be solved by modifying brain biochemistry, and if you just snap out of it, more or less. So underestimating the problem. In the days of psychoanalysis, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, analysts, mental health professionals of the time, knew that a proper course of treatment takes years, and they were committed to a one-on-one relationship for many years. And this was called the therapeutic alliance. It was an alliance. It was a war, and you were allies against the disorder. But this state of mind changed in the 1980s with the introduction of brief psychotherapies, with the introduction of miracle drugs. Everything became instant. You have a problem? What is it? Codependence. Okay, take this, take that 3 times a day. Come and see me once a month and for 1 year, and it'll be over. Well, sorry, no way to treat codependence, let alone narcissistic personality disorder. It must be a committed relationship for many years. 5 to 8, maybe 10, before the root problem is solved. Medication can tackle side effects. It can tackle certain behaviors, modify certain behaviors. It can make you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the equivalent of alcoholism. It's a drug addiction.
What? It's like a, what is it?
Medication.
What is it? Yeah, it is.
It's a drug addiction.
Right, Tom, I call pills. And this is exactly the point that you're making right here, is the point that I made in that poem. I always tell my doctor, I only have a psychiatrist now because of therapy. It was too expensive to continue medication. I need it. It is an addiction, and I need it. I will do whatever I need to do in order to ensure that I keep on working with that. But I gave up on psychotherapy, which you're saying is most important. So that kind of scares me. I said pills, and then in parentheses, overdosed by prescription.
Alone and laid to rest is just the same, as rest is never quite achieved, and loneliness is impossible when doubts chatter constantly. She wonders if she took her pills today, then remembers that in her encapsulated state, medication is no longer prescribed, and pharmacies aren't open this far underground. The doctors wished her well, or so she thought, as she waved goodbye and walked out of their offices, holding signed papers that promised mental stability, while delivering only a sense of such an achievement. The final straw was sucked too dry to chase the gifts the papers offered. The bottles laid empty upon the floor, next to a body that only seemed to have stopped breathing. They found her too many days later, photos, IDs, and boxes of memories surrounded. Yet it seemed no one could identify her remains. She lays buried among soldiers killed in battle, underneath a tombstone that simply says, unknown, and wonders if she took the pills yet today.
So, do you see why I thought that had a lot to do with what we're saying?
Yes.
It's an absolute addiction.
Yes.
All day long, you wonder if I took them yet, did I take them yet? And you could, you know, with being so ADD, the Adderall could be right next to my bed. But until I have the Adderall, I don't have the ability to go pick it up and take it. And it's an addiction, and you need the drugs. I need Adderall to function. Now, that's absolutely ridiculous, right?
This is the hitch in modern psychiatry. It medicalized all the conditions. So what do you have? You have a narcissist who is addicted to narcissistic supply, and instead of treating him, you make him addicted to drugs. So you exchange one addiction for another. You have a codependent who is addicted to relationship and so on. And rendering this codependent a non-addict, you actually convert this codependent into a drug addict. So what are you doing with it? You're replacing one type of addiction with another type of addiction. That's not curing, that's not healing, that's drug pushing for the pharmaceutical industry.
I always said that I don't have an addictive personality, which is actually ridiculous because I'm very addictive. I'm just addicted to other people's problems. I selfie by having people that are more screwed up than I am, so I don't have to think about my own issues. And so I have a very addictive personality. So what do you do with the depression and the anxiety and the post-traumatic stress or ADHD that you might suffer? What do you do if you don't medicate those? Because I know there was points at the beginning I was suicidal. The medication saved my life. But at this point, it's been so many years.
I'm not talking about extreme situations.
Right.
Extreme depression with suicidal ideation. That's, of course, psychosis. This, of course, requires medication. You're trained to evaluate. You're trained to read the TV, to read the signs. Of course, you know. Suicide is usually preceded by suicidal ideation, for instance.
Of course.
The problem of modern psychiatry is that the emphasis is on drugs and medication, and there's much less emphasis on interpersonal relationships, therapeutic alliance, long-term commitment, and treating the root causes of problems.
Yeah.
And that's why everyone walks around like zombies, you know, flooded with drugs and not much happier for it. There is a mixture of bodily diseases, physiological diseases, schizophrenia, to a large extent depression, and to some extent psychopathy, are biological diseases.
Yeah.
They're the equivalent of tuberculosis and of cancer. They are body diseases, biochemistry of the brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
brain damage.
And brain damage, brain injury.
What's it called when you have mild depression your whole life? Yes, I've always had that. But I wonder if the abuse is what damaged the brain. Because I know for sex addicts, you know, the center of their mind that's abused, that has damaged is the pleasure and pain, you know, area. That's why they like, you know, S&M and things, hard for them to evaluate between what's pleasure and what's pain. It's bowel pleasure. When it comes to depression, is it really that you can chemically be born, or do you think that just at such an early age you receive that abuse that you can get the damage from that?
Brain is elastic and self-mending to some extent. But of course, if the abuse is severe, repeated, and at a very early age, then the damage is permanent. Yeah, sure. For some disorders, like narcissistic personality disorder, I'm pretty pessimistic because narcissism, pathological narcissism, is truly the outcome of horrendous abuse. The abuse doesn't have to be physical, sexual, or so on. As I told you last time, if you have a doting, smothering mother, that's also a type of abuse.
Let me ask you then, you said you suffered extreme abuse prior to 16. If you're open enough to discuss that, can you describe what kind of things you faced at that age?
I was very severely, to the point of life risk, abused between the ages of 4 and 16.
But you don't want to get more specific? Physical, so you're physically beaten.
Physically, verbally, psychologically. I get very, very specific and graphic in my short stories. There's a story called Nothing is Happening at Home.
Let me ask you a question real quick. Sexually, were you sexually abused? Because I know that sexual abuse a lot of times is, maybe that's what pushes people to the sadistic end more.
No, I was sexually abused. And sexual abuse usually tends to breed borderline personality disorder.
Yes.
Histrionic.
Yes.
Less narcissists and psychopaths are usually not sexually abused, but they are physically abused and psychologically or verbally abused and so on. But again, it's very important to understand that abuse can masquerade as love. Parent who is smothering, doting, spoiling, and so on is as abusive as a parent who is physically abusive, beats the child or anything. These are also forms of abuse.
And also the parent that sits and watches and doesn't do anything is even
I don't know, somewhat I believe they're even more at fault because they know the difference between right or wrong. Because you could have a mother or father that's borderline personality, and though there's no excuse for it, they could be abusive because of their chemistry. But the parent that knows the difference and doesn't do anything, whether they're abusive or not, I think in a way is, could be worse than the one that...
Yeah, the other parent. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Because they know.
Absolutely. But, you know, people are hostages of situations and hostages of other people. The other parent usually is afraid to lose his mate or his wife or his, you know, it's difficult. These are very highly complex situations. The child is actually sacrificed by one parent so as to maintain the relationship. It's the price the other parent pays.
It is. I mean, I see sometimes when I watch situations where the parent, you can see the anger, but I don't say guilt. They're angry at the other parent for doing what they're doing, but at the same time, their guilt's not there. They don't feel bad at the child, but they don't really look at the child's point of view on it at all.
They go through a typical cycle. They deny that there is abuse. To start with, they deny. The vast majority of other parents simply deny. You ask them, nothing is happening at home. Everything is okay. Yeah, she may be a bit harsh, she may be fierce, she may be this, she may be that, but it's nothing out of the ordinary, so there's denial. And then there's rage when the denial no longer works, and then there's depression, and then there's withdrawal. And finally, there's acceptance of the abuse, and the abuse becomes a personal or family mythology. It becomes a narrative, an organizing principle. Additionally, only some children are singled out for abuse. This is called emergent role. Emergent roles in psychology means a role that is assigned to you as a child. And the role of victim is assigned to some children, but not to all of them. You can have a family of five, and only one of them will be abused, or two.
Maybe just one more, much more extreme than the others. But why?
Yeah.
How is that child singled out? Is it just the time they occur in life, or is there any reason?
Well, children are born with a raw form of personality, some basic, primitive, atavistic personality. And this personality attitudes and so on. This personality and attitudes, they can grate on the vulnerabilities and sensitivities of a parent. For instance, if a child is highly independent-minded, autonomous, or if a child cries too much, codependent, demands clinging, and so on. So it depends. It's a reaction usually to the child's raw personality, to the basic scheme or framework of the personality.
You know very well, obviously, that in the Seder book for Passover, for those of you who aren't Jewish, we have the holiday called Passover, and we have Seder, and we read through a book before we eat, and Sam is... Right, that's why I'm saying for other people, I know you're a fellow Israelite. For those who don't know, it's a book that we read, and they have the children. There's the wise child, and they said the wicked child. Everybody said Audrey. And all I ever remember, I've always been overly nice to the point where people think I'm stupid or people take advantage, but I was always the wicked one, and I never understood why.
That's an example of an emergent role. Your emergent role was... It gets on.
Yeah.
But you see what happens. The emergent role becomes a life habit. It becomes what we call in psychology a comfort zone. If you've been singled out by your parents to be the victim of abuse, you will feel comfortable being the victim of abuse even when you're 50 years old. You will actually seek abuse. You will provoke abuse. You will feel extremely suspicious when you are not being abused. You will become an abuse-seeking codependent. And you will marry a succession of men who are abusers.
Uh-huh.
You would gravitate to abusers and so on. This is all the outcome of childhood treatment. And again, I emphasize, abuse does not mean only beating and incest. A spoiling parent, a doting, a smothering parent treats the child as an object. And that's also abuse.
Now, that's going to be because sometimes with the borderline, they could be more smothering and loving. And then it's all the black and white of devil angel. So they could be smothering and then take that away in a whim and be you're the devil.
It's even more basic than that. That's because the smothering, the doting are conditional. Love given by some parents is usually conditional. Succumb. If you obey, you'll be loved. If you don't, you'll be hated. It's not that you will not be loved. You will be coldly, maliciously, and silently hated. And this is the choice you're faced with as a child. You depend on these people for survival. Become what we want you to become, or else. And you become what they want you to become. If they want you to become a victim of abuse, that's what you become. If they want you to become a prodigy, that's what you become. You become what they want you to become. They mold you. You're a raw material. And this is horrible, because a child should receive unconditional love. I can be angry at you as a parent, but I will never stop loving you. And you are not bad because you did something bad. You are not what you do. You are not your afraid.
Yeah.
You are the objects of unconditional love. I can condemn what you do. I can be angry at you. I can punish you even, but I will never stop loving.
We were talking about the court system, and you had said before that narcissists should never have custody of their child. Is that what you believe?
Yes, I absolutely believe that. Well, narcissists should not have custody because they are children of immense gratification, and there is a today revolution in extreme cases. So narcissists are simply different. They are predators. They consume other people the way one consumes food. Some adults can cope with narcissists. Children simply cannot, either in the form of harm and hurt, or in the form of being transformed into a narcissist or an abuse oneself. So the child is shielded and protected. Now, even the most benign, those who are not likely to engage in incest and those who are not likely to physically abuse the child, even they can have a part of the even these out-of-show appointment and rape when the child refuses to comply, refuses to act with the child's wishes, preferences, hopes, fears, and always prefer their own to the child. And above all, when disappointed, they are bound to be ferocious. Child is bound to be traumatized by the display of hatred, loathing, rage, unbridled, which a narcissist will throw at him the first instant the child disappoints the narcissist. Narcissists don't have impulse control, and their reactions are disproportionate. The child, they react with the same rage to more for a gift or something, and this is because the child is not emotional. This is, and I'm thinking about nice, but narcissists. Now imagine a sadist. Imagine a narcissist. You know, it's endless. It's narcissists easily glide and shift from one to the other of a narcissist, and as proximity, with proximity, and as the child grows up, develops body organs, the narcissist can become incestuous. Narcissists simply regard children as objects of gratification. It's simple as that. There's no need even to go further than that. And children should not be allowed to be in their presence.
So if there's a way that you can get custody, you can stop feeling guilty and just go forward and do whatever you can to get custody of your child, knowing that that's the right thing.
If you believe that the other parent is a narcissist, let alone if he is a narcissistic disorder, you must, or a sadist, you must defend your child. And you must deny the narcissist not only custody, but if possible, visitation right. Of course, you must do it without seeming to be vindictive, fearing to be fostering parental alienation. You must walk a very thin line, because narcissists are great actors. They have thespian skills. You know, they appear in court and the judge falls in love with them. They imitate sensitivity, simulate empathy. They have these great emotional resonance states where they behave and then imitate them. They appear and sympathetic and wonderful and emotional and feeling and everything. And and evaluated and the psychologists and the supporter and everyone falls in love with them, and you end up being a parent and so it's a very dangerous game line to work to protect the child.
It's funny because another reason I first episode, I asked the two questions you said I could ask more. PhD, and I found the thing where you see something that's just a post-traumatic stress syndrome side effect. And then the other question I asked whether or not the difference or what you were when the psychological narcissism was, but I asked if
Hello?
Hello?
I mean, Audrey, you're breaking up.
Am I?
Yeah, you're breaking up.
Okay. So, yeah, let me go right now.
I'm coming back.
All right, right.
Okay, fair enough. Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, I'm right here.
Is it better?
It's better, but I haven't heard the last question.
Okay. I was saying that... the second question I asked you was my favorite line of yours I use all the time, but I always give you credit, knowledge is not transformation. And I knew that the narcissists that ever, as I've learned from you, don't get healed, but that basically acknowledge the fact that they are narcissists are forced to realize what they are. And so they were trying to do an escape and say, I sold drugs, which of course they had no evidence of, but I don't know what they can do. I'm scared. And so I contacted you. He was saying, I sold him drugs, and that's why he went crazy. And I knew that you were sent, so I wanted to see, he went to the gym, lost everything, maybe that 2% can become agent.
You're breaking up badly.
Am I breaking up right now?
Badly.
Oh, okay. Hold on. I'll try to fix it. Do you talk to them about where they can find your book and stuff, since we're going to do that in about 5 minutes anyway, and I'll try to fix my end.
Can't you take 5 minutes for the next time? Or how does it go?
I just want you to have some time to tell them about your links and what different things that you're doing.
Now you sound well. Now I'm doing well.
So I was going to say that other part was that because he was seeing, you know, Indians in the sky and, you know, the clouds are talking to him. So I wondered if that 2% could become psychotic, since he was trying to say it was drug induced. But you had said that your one example of what can happen in a situation where all narcissistic supply was lost was that one, they will break into your home. Two, they will abduct your child. Three, they will kill you. And four, they will kill all of you. And that was just ridiculous, because that was my situation. He broke into my home, tried to abduct my son. He said the world was coming to an end and he had to get him away. And if I wasn't a believer to follow, he would kill me. And then, you know, so besides the fourth part, and the only thing he actually did was break in. But we were saying with them court, when I went and got the restraining order attempt about the 15th time, this time I thought, you know, he was arrested for burglary too, for breaking and entering to cause harm. And the guy says, no, I don't imminent danger. And in this courtroom where he broke into my home, and I said, well, he broke in to cause harm. He broke in to take my son and kill me. Yes, but you were hiding. And I said, yeah, I was hiding. Well, that was your problem, because if he hit you in the head with the door, then that would have been imminent danger. And to me, that's ridiculous. But this is the court system, the way that they work with the narcissist, I suppose.
Yeah. Narcissists are prone to psychotic attacks, but these are very brief, some seconds. Sometimes they last seconds, sometimes, but as a maximum, they can last a few hours or a day or two. And during these attacks, the narcissists are as dangerous. Narcissists are as dangerous as any paranoid schizophrenic would be. And when this is coupled with substance abuse and with underlying paranoia, and many are paranoid, suspicious of everything, with persecutory delusions, believe themselves to be the centers of conspiracy, or feel that they are being wronged and that they are victims and so on, when this is coupled with all these complexes and problems, then this really truly becomes very dangerous. The dynamic of stalkers is pretty similar. We have stalkers who are also psychotic. For instance, the erotomaniac stalker, the stalker that believes that you're in love with him no matter what you do, no matter what you say. Everything you do and say is because you don't know better, or because and your slightest movement, your speech, anything you do is a coded message. And so this is psychosis, form of psychosis, delusions. Many narcissists are delusional, sometimes psychotic, when they are also paranoid, and definitely when they abuse substances, they are it's a very, very dangerous mixture. Actually, recent studies have shown that well over 70% of all serial killers, an amazing number, are actually narcissists, not as was thought. Previously, it was thought they were psychopaths, but recent research has proven that well over 70% are narcissists, not psychopaths. They are narcissists who are also delusional, paranoid, and most of them also abuse substances of one type or another and had a criminal lifestyle. But they were essentially and basically narcissists. So narcissists are very, very dangerous, definitely.
Yeah, I can get that. And that's the thing, is he does always had some mild substance abuse problems for whatever different kind of abuse, but never strong enough to call him an addict of it, even though he is the side effect, I guess. Yeah. It's 11:25, and I wanted to give you some chance. You and I have some projects going on with the web as well, but we'll go into that later. But you have so many different things going on the web, and I mentioned to you that as I've been researching these shows and how to market them, I found that almost every domestic violence page I go to, you're quoted usually on the homepage. I never really saw the span that you have in, I guess I would call it an industry, but it's not in this market, in this niche
cottage,
market.
Cottage industry.
Yeah, whatever it may be, it is when it comes to biz, it is your target market. At the same time, you have gotten so much reception. I mean, everywhere, Sam Vaknin, and it's just, it amazes me what you've created with this. I mean, obviously, you're very able, but it's very few people, that, no matter how talented they may be at anything, to be able to make any kind of... So,
no, thanks. I think I don't attribute it to my talents. I think I've simply been around a long time. I started Pipeplace. I created the first serious website about narcissistic personality disorder on the web in 1997.
Is that
1997. Yeah, the same.
Sam
Vaknin
Tripod?
It's sambaknin.tripod.com or www.narcissistic-abuse.com.
So who owns sambaknin.com? Because I tried to buy that for our little web project, but it was already sold.
All right. Yeah, we did.
Yeah, nobody owns it. they want you to buy it from them, probably.
Yeah, probably. At any rate, so I've been around a long time. I'm the granddaddy of narcissistic abuse. My website was the first. I coined many of the phrases that are being used today and so on. That's on one hand. On the other hand, as I told you last time, I'm also a lightning rod. I'm also a representation, a reification, and I stand in for the abusers in many victims' lives. So when they come online, they find my website and they find an abuser, me, and they feel that I stand in for their abusers. They feel that I'm sort of the king of abusers, and they vent, and there's a lot of spleen and bad mouthing, and they get back at their abusers through me.
And you love
but
it, though.
It's okay.
You love it.
It's okay with me. I understand that they need to vent. They
but
need
also
to.
Gives them power to you that you have power in their lives.
It's catharsis. For them, as far as they're concerned, it's cathartic. That means after they call me names and after they vilify me and after they vent and after they badmouth and everything, they feel that they got back at their abuser, even though it was through me. I'm their abuser by proxy. And that's okay. If I fulfill this role in the lightning rod, if I let them vent through me and get closure through me by humiliating me, punishing me, that's okay with me. Because I'm not really humiliated and I'm not really punished. So.
We have 90 seconds, Sam, so I want to quickly go through your website before they hang up.
So that's it. So go online, search Malignant Self-Love, and you'll most probably find me. Also go to my YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Sam Vaknin, one word, my name, Sam Vaknin, S-A-M-V-A-K-N-I-N. And there are 140 videos by now. There's I'm planning another 150.
And I know that we are putting together a page now where you have a bunch of zip files available to our readers that they're going to download for free, actually, as a gift.
Absolutely. We can also place books there, and we can also place the videos themselves. They'll be able to download them from there. We've just started, and I hope we'll do something nice to this.
Oh, no, we will. And I totally am honored that I get to work with you, and thank you so much for that. I will talk to you, I suppose, or next week or the following, and I look forward to our future conversations.
So do I. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Sam. Have a wonderful day.
Bye,
night. I've gotten it down. Have
night.
A great night. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you all so much for being a part of our show today. I appreciate you guys that are here now and those that are planning to listen to the archive. Have a wonderful week. Thank you so much. Audrey Michelle. Bye.